Just before we start today, are you a teacher? Most listeners aren't, because we aim this show at students. But if you are an educator of some form, I just wanted to let you know that I'm co-authoring a special series this month on effective studying with this week's podcast guest, Peps McRae, for his famous ultra-concise, ultra-high-value Evidence Snacks email newsletter. In the three-part series we've put together, I'm sharing some of my all-time favourite tips and tricks that I've learned over the years to help embed smarter study strategies in your school, helping students study smarter, not harder, going beyond the research recommendations to figure out exactly what we need to be telling students to help them put good ideas into practice. In the email series, I'm even giving away some of my teaching resources so you can pick up some ready-to-teach lessons so you can deliver these ideas directly into your school. So you get slides, a little video, and even a workbook for your learners. Follow the link in the episode description to catch up on any emails in the series that you might have missed so far, and then sign up to Peps's Evidence Snacks email list to get the rest of the series delivered directly to your inbox. For everyone else listening, all my non-teacher friends studying hard for their exams at school, university and more, I just wanted to say, especially if your exams are coming up soon over the next few weeks, hang in there, my friends, keep going, you've got this. And now, here's today's episode.
Welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast, helping you ace your exams at school and university through the psychology of high performance and the science of studying smarter, not harder. It's my pleasure to introduce your host, the Cambridge-trained memory psychologist and exam success coach, William Wadsworth!
Hello and welcome to the Exam Study Experts podcast. By the time this episode broadcasts, all being well, I'll be proud dad to a second little girl. Our eldest is 2.5 years old, so a long way herself from taking exams and really worrying about academic life at all. But I know there are many listeners to the show who are parents themselves, or perhaps as families listening together in the car on the school run. So today I wanted to do something a little different, and just for this one episode, extend a hand to all the parents out there and see if we can't offer a few useful tips to help you and your family navigate together the academic jungle. It's a rare family for whom the subject of academic progress is never even the tiniest source of tension. I think that's quite a common source of tension in the family. So to help bring some peace to the conversations, address some of the common questions I hear from parents, and generally help families support each other as best as possible, I've invited Dr. Tamara Soles, child psychologist, parent coach, and podcaster herself, to share some of her vast expertise and wisdom with us today. I have my pen at the ready, and I'll be taking notes too. Let's meet Tamara and dive right into today's conversation.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tamara Soles. I am a child psychologist and founder of the Secure Child Center for Families and Children in Montreal, where I supervise a group of clinicians, and we work with teens, kids, families, and young adults even. And I'm also a mom of 2 10-year-old twins, so I get to practice the things that I talk about on a daily, if not hourly, basis.
Wonderful, wonderful. Tamara, I wanted to ask, if you were to sort of sum up some of your, I guess, kind of core philosophies or sort of what you feel you sort of stand for in your work, I just wondered how you might sort of sum up a little bit of those sort of central thought in your work.
Yes. Connection is the key word that is the sort of tie that binds, no pun intended, through all of my work. And so my goal is to help families bring back some of the peace that's often lost in their homes because they're mired in power struggles or homework battles, and help them embrace what we know from brain science actually helps a child and teen develop. So ditching the traditional old school parenting that we know doesn't work and often makes things more difficult, and to help them use connection and brain science to help their children develop.
It's really interesting that we're having this conversation. I was speaking to a parent and a client of some of the work I do just a couple of days ago, and they described their relationship with their son, as it was, as being not like a parent and child, but as like Hitler and child. Such was the anxiety and pressure they were under ahead of their, this was the kind of the main exams we take at sort of age 16 in the UK.
Yeah.
GCSEs, if anyone's familiar with that system from the UK or around the world. So, you know, it just goes to show like how, I guess, confrontational these relationships can become at the sharp end.
Absolutely.
Sure, that's a fairly extreme example, but you know, you mentioned the tension around homework and sort of getting things done. And so I wondered if you might just sort of share any perspectives on, firstly, what sort of do you see as some of the challenges or the kind of we might fall into around, you know, parents and child sort of managing those relationships around academic progress and doing well at school?
Yes. I think there's so many facets to it, but one of them is that we certainly in Western culture are very much stuck in a culture of achievement and of status. And from earlier and earlier, parents are given messages that if their child isn't in the right school or the right program, even in some places starting as early as preschool, if you can believe it, they're given these messages that there's a right one for their child, and that's the one that will open the next doors for their child. And of course, we all want the best for our children. But when we find ourselves stuck in that position of there's one path and there's one way to do things, it puts a lot of pressure both on parents and subsequently on our children and teens. So when it comes to the academic piece, number one, I want parents to remember that academics is really just one part of a child's life. It may feel like it's their entire life, but it's one part. And so being able to just zoom out and take that perspective that academics are important and doing as well as we can is important, but that it's one part of who your child is. And I so often see parents working with their children who are struggling, and they'll have tutor after tutor after tutor. And yet this child may have a passion for playing tennis or a passion for football, and they don't have the time or the coach dedicated to them to develop those skills. So just keeping in mind that your child is a whole person, just like you are as an adult, and that we can support their academics without putting a pressure on them that suggests that there is one way to do things and it has to be a certain way and there has to be a certain school or certain path in order for them to be quote unquote successful in life, depending on how we're defining success.
So I think that's such an important point about, you know, we're a whole person and it's not just all about the academics. And I think one of the, I guess, specific challenges that I sometimes hear is there's this kind of tension between, well, okay, I don't want to put my child under pressure, but then if I don't put them under pressure, they're just going to not perform and fail. And, you know, when it's a major set of public exams,
absolutely,
that matters. And it's sort of their future on the line and their future college or university that, you know, they might be able to get into or not get into and their career prospects. And yeah, so you end up with a solution, well, I'm going to put the pressure on and make it happen. Like, what are your thoughts on that challenge?
Yes. So you're absolutely right. As lofty as my goals might be about a variety of pathways in life, there still exists a system, an academic system, certainly in the US and Canada and in the UK as well, that does very much have a prestige element to certain universities or programs that will only allow a certain percentage of people in it. And that percentage seems to be getting lower and lower amongst some of these so-called higher tiered schools. So it is a very real pressure in that sense. And it is something that parents have to balance. And there was one really fascinating study where they asked students about the perceived importance of various elements of their lives that their parents held. And what was found was that students who perceived parents as valuing academics above all else not only did poorer in academics, but also in their social emotional well-being. So their mental health and their academic success was being impacted by the perception that parents valued academics over everything else. In contrast, when they perceived that parents valued kindness and connection as the same or higher than academics, those students not only did better emotionally, but they actually did better academically as well. So sometimes it's not so much about just taking off all academic pressure as much as it is adding in the value of connection with each other, with friends, with our community, or whatever is important to you. And just explicitly making that value known in your family. And when kids and teens can see that, that does shift the perceived pressure on them. So you can still navigate this very real system that we live in while still valuing these other aspects of our well-being.
It's a really interesting study. The thought that went through my mind when you were describing it was, I wonder if we spoke to those parents of the children that said, oh, you know, I perceive that my parent values academics above all others. I reckon if we spoke to a lot of those parents, my hunch is that most of them would say, well, of course I don't. You know, of course, kindness is more important, you know, so the children are kind of getting that perception, but it may not necessarily be aligned with what the parents think the child should be perceiving. So I guess, what would be your kind of advice to parents in terms of our words or actions for making sure that those, you know, other values are brought to the fore?
Yes. Like,
how do we make sure that happens?
Yes, I agree with you 100%. I think most parents would say that they value those things above all else. What we also know is that most of us, when we identify our values, have a fairly clear set of values. But when we look at our lives, many of us are not having those values reflected in our day-to-day lives the way that we would want or expect them to. So that applies to us as parents or as adults and to our children and teens. So it's really about making it explicit by saying things like, yes, it is absolutely important that you also have time to go out with your friends, or we're going to stop homework at a certain time so that we can spend some one-on-one time together, or we're going to schedule regular weekly family meals, or even doing something in the community together. Even just going for a walk. So a lot of the times when I'm working with parents, they will recognize that their teen needs to do things like move their bodies and get outside and get fresh air, and that all of that will help their studying. But then they're just telling their teen to go outside. And rather than just telling them, use that opportunity for connection, right? So build in ritual. Let's go for our walk today. And granted, as children age, the types of activities they might want to do with their parent can change. It's also perfectly cool to just get on the gaming device with your kid and play a game of Fortnite or whatever it is that you're playing. So connection comes in a variety of ways, but just actually showing up with your actions and saying, I want to do this with you, and making that a priority in the same way that we would hold sleep to be a priority for a teen, right? Knowing that if they're studying until 2 o'clock in the morning, it's a loss at the end, because what they're going to lose in sleep is not going to be made up for by the things they were trying to learn at 1 o'clock in the morning. So we try to hold those boundaries of maintaining those things that are important to us as individuals and to our children and teens.
Be the change you want to see in your household.
Exactly.
I think that's great. I wanted to ask about rewards and punishments. So one of the sort of classic fallback strategies for behavior change is threatening punishment or promising a reward. And,
yeah,
you know, that might be, okay, well, we're going to bribe you to get certain grades, or we're going to threaten you with certain consequences if you perform poorly. Or it could just be sort of slightly more, you know, softer forms of reward and punishment, like just praising their good outcomes or verbally admonishing their poor outcomes. I wondered what your thoughts are on this particular issue.
Yes, that's a great question. So first of all, when it comes to rewards, we know that rewards can backfire when things are intrinsically motivating already. So if I'm intrinsically motivated to try to do well at school, I'm a conscientious student, adding in rewards can actually shift that motivation from an intrinsic one to an extrinsic one. So for those who might not be familiar with those terms, what that means is I'm naturally motivated to do well, and I'm not doing it for the reward. I'm doing it for the satisfaction that I have in doing well, or for the possibility of reaching my goals. But an extrinsic motivation is when I'm being motivated by something outside, like a reward. So if it shifts my natural motivation, that's a problem for kids and teens. Now, for kids who might not naturally be motivated by those things, sometimes a reward can be a good kickstart for a habit, like getting into a study routine or something like that. Or even just small things like a self-care kind of reward, like I'm going to just, you know, I'll do this much of my essay and then I'm going to make myself a hot chocolate. So there's things like that that can be sort of built in that are not meant to be a reward for an outcome, but more helping with routine and those executive functioning strategies like time management and organization. So building in those kinds of things can be helpful. What we know about punishment, on the other hand, is that punishment generally in the long term is ineffective, primarily because it erodes the parent-child relationship even more. And that, again, is putting the child at risk for emotional and physical and academic risks. And in the end, they end up sort of not doing things or doing things for the wrong reasons, right? So essentially, what we want to do, our goal, is to raise children and teens who are able to use their own values and moral compass to make decisions. And when children and teens are raised primarily with reward and punishment, they shift to making decisions based on whether there will be a reward or whether there won't be a punishment. And so classic example is, you know, parents go away and the teen is home alone on a weekend. And, you know, we want them to not destroy the house in a house party, because that's important to them, that their parent trusts them, that they have that sense of responsibility, not because they're fairly certain they can get away with it. So we want to kind of remove that overarching reward punishment model and help them develop routines and be as motivated internally as they can be. And like I said, we can use some built-in rewards for that. But the other challenge with rewarding things like grades is that we're putting emphasis on the wrong part. Ideally, we want kids at all levels of education to be learning how to learn. It's not so much about the fact that they learn, because we can all look those facts up at some point later in life. It's about knowing how to learn and how I learn best. And so when we value only the outcome, it puts kids at risk for not pushing themselves beyond their comfort zone, so that they only focus on showing things they know. They won't do the harder math question because they don't want to risk getting it wrong. And we really want to shift that emphasis to the process. So if we want to, whether it's verbal praise, for example, I tend to think of it more as encouragement, right? So rather than like a good job, it's more like, wow, you know, you've been at this for quite a long time today. That's really impressive. There's a lot going on and you've really stuck with this today. Or, you know, a big paper that they're writing. Again, like, I'm impressed how you really broke that up. You know, there's so many elements to it and it gets overwhelming, but I really like how you did that outline and did a draft first. So it's really about drawing attention to the process rather than the outcome.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. So trying to perhaps avoid punishments. And then when it comes to rewards, using lighter rewards rather than extravagant rewards to kind of maximize that intrinsic motivation and not kind of erode that intrinsic will to perform the task for its own intrinsic reward.
That's right.
And then when it comes to the reward, you know, what you are rewarding, focusing on rewarding the process, the work yeah. that's gone into it, the effort, not necessarily the outcome.
Exactly.
Be it good or bad.
Yes. And the other thing I'll add is that for a lot of neurodivergent students, ADHD students, for example, autistic students, there may be some differences in the way the reward systems of the brain operate. And so what might feel naturally rewarding to one person may not be as rewarding to another. And so all the more reason to empower them to figure out what is motivating to me. And again, whether it's that hot chocolate at the end. Clearly, I like chocolate, so I keep using chocolate as an example. But it doesn't have to be. Maybe you get to watch that program that you really like after you're done a certain segment of something. So just being mindful of your own brain as a student and what you need to succeed in terms of a reward, whether it's a reward where you watch YouTube for 20 minutes or you move your body outside or you eat something that you like. So just being aware that each individual person might need to structure those rewards or breaks a little bit differently.
That's interesting. We might touch on sort of neurodiversity again in just a moment.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask, so we've kind of been in the world of motivation a little bit. We've been talking about rewards and punishments, which we plan to avoid as kind of one strategy. I just wondered if you'd say anything else on this general subject of, well, okay, my child's just not motivated to do well or to put in the work. Yeah, beyond the kind of things we've already been mentioning, is there anything else you'd throw in as good tips on that question?
I think one thing to keep in mind is that every kid wants to do well. And if they're not, and if they're not motivated, something else is going on. And it's very easy as parents, because we're frustrated and feel helpless sometimes, to just kind of wash our hands and be like, well, my kid is lazy, or my kid doesn't have any motivation to do anything. But kids want to do well, and teens want to do well. So if they're not, they're either protecting some element of their ego in some way, or something else is going on, meaning that maybe they're struggling in school and they need some support in order to do better. Or maybe there's something about the learning environment that isn't working for them that needs to be modified in some way. So as a psychologist, we might use an assessment to try to figure out, is there something else that's going on that might be undermining their own motivation? It could be anything from sleep to their mental health, depression, anxiety, or a learning difference. So just keeping in mind that everybody wants to do well. And if they're not showing motivation or they're not eager to do something, it's good to zoom out and try to figure out what might be going on.
Yeah, that's great advice. So touching on this kind of idea of neurodiversity, I just wondered if you had any particular thoughts on kind of particular challenges that you might face if you have some form of neurodivergence or even kind of mental health. Why might things be a little bit more challenging for you? Possibly, not necessarily, but possibly it's in your kind of educational journey. And what are the first steps you might take to go about helping create those conditions so you can get the support or conditions you need to thrive and do better?
Yes, it's a big topic, but it's a topic that I love to talk about. So I'm happy to dive in as deep as you would like me to when it comes to neurodiversity. But, you know, first of all, neurodiversity is a biological fact, meaning all brains are wired differently. That's, you know, not a fad. That's not a belief system. That's just a biological fact. So neurodiversity in itself is a biological fact. The fact that many neurodivergent individuals should be seen as having strengths and challenges just like anybody else seems to be hard for some people to wrap their brains around. I don't know why, but ultimately it's about understanding that these conditions or this particular pattern of brain wiring is not necessarily in and of itself a disorder. The disorder often comes between the mismatch between how our society and our world is structured and how they're expected to navigate that system. And the school system is a good/bad example of that, meaning that schools were designed for a very specific purpose. And originally, that purpose really wasn't education per se. And so they're structured with classrooms that may be too big for a lot of students in terms of the number of students and the amount of attention that they really need. They might be too busy from a sensory perspective. It could be too noisy. There may be a lot of distractions. They're also required to sit still for long parts of the day that I know many adults couldn't handle if they had to go back to a classroom now. And so there's so many elements about how the school system is designed that don't work for a lot of neurodivergent individuals. So again, it's really about trying to figure out how does any one person's brain work best and what are the conditions that would help them? So do they need a classroom that has fewer people and more direct attention? Do they need a calmer environment? Do they need some noise-canceling headphones or some noise reducers in their ears? Do they need to take sensory breaks or be allowed to stand up and move their bodies at the, you know, at the back of the class? Or do they have fidget toys? So there's a lot of those kinds of environmental things to consider. And then the other elements that are important are how they show their learning. So for example, if somebody is doing, let's say, a book report, and they're trying to teach the class about what they learned from this book, if the object is really just to convey the meaning of the book, then they should be allowed to do that in whatever way makes sense for their brains. So that could be in a written format. It could be on Bristol board. That could be an oral presentation. It could be a play. So people shouldn't be limited to just one method of demonstrating their knowledge if that's not what fits for their brain. Now, if the object is practicing oral speaking, that's a different story. So when that's the object, fine. But when the task is not about the method, then allowing for creativity for all students, which would benefit all students, but in particular for the neurodivergent individual who may benefit from showing what they know in a very specific way. So again, it's trying to figure out how to work with a student's brain and help them navigate all these elements of school One of the things that comes up often when I'm working with a lot of autistic individuals is that they are so detail-oriented in general that sometimes studying can be overwhelming because they may have a harder time figuring out the higher level stuff to pull out. So they get so stuck in all of the details, and the notes that they have tend to be 5 times as long or 10 times as long as some of their other students. So they might need help in knowing what is really being asked of you for an exam or for a test, and how do we focus on those elements and not get so caught up in the color coding of 10 pages of notes on a small thing. And so again, it's just an individual thing, and it's knowing how their brains work and how to work within what the school is asking or what an exam is needing and what that student can do and show.
Just understanding, you know, how your brain works, what your strengths, weaknesses, and then adapting accordingly so you can mitigate some of the things that are a little bit more challenging to you and at the same time kind of maximize the areas you have strength in.
That's exactly it.
I guess beyond that, you know, there's the advice sort of branches in all sorts of different directions depending on, you know, what exact challenges and strengths you have. And that's the whole point of the word, you know, that's the divergence bit of the
word
neurodivergent.
That's right. Exactly.
So, just sort of understanding what it is for you and adapting accordingly. Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent. One other question I wanted to put to you is a sort of listener question who wrote to me a short while ago and was asking about kind of advice for kind of maintaining your progress at school or college despite sort of adverse circumstances or kind of recent trauma. You know, I know this is something you think about in your work too. If someone has, let's say, not the ideal kind of life context in terms of poverty, difficult conditions, recent trauma. Yeah, like how's the interplay with that in your kind of academic world?
Yeah.
Obviously, this huge amount of stuff could be going on for you. But, you know, how do you compartmentalize so you can keep making some progress at school? Like, yeah, just interested in your thoughts on that challenge.
Yeah, I think it's a question of being able to learn to focus on the parts we have control over. And that's a hard lesson that many of us, even as adults, still grapple with at times. But being able to say, you know, yes, this may be really difficult. And maybe there is something really significant that has occurred, some trauma or something that maybe you do need to take a little bit of a break. Or, you know, if you're in a high school or university where there's counseling available, that might be something to avail yourself of in order to have some emotional support to get through. So first of all, recognize that these things may very well likely impact your ability to pay attention to things, your ability to complete tasks and focus. So just recognizing that, yeah, if you've been through something pretty significant, give yourself some compassion that it might have a little bit of a toll for a while and seek some support that may be available to you. But again, coming back to what can I control in this circumstance? So maybe there's elements that I can't, and that's really difficult and sad. And I can also do X, Y, and Z thing to help myself. So I can focus on my sleep, or I can focus on shoring up my connection with friends. I can focus on studying the materials that I have when I have them. I can focus on eating well or exercising or moving my body or doing things that I know can help me overall still put all of the pieces together that I have control over, right? And so recognizing that some threads are bigger than others. Obviously, poverty is going to impact us in so many ways. And that's a systemic issue that would be necessary to have some sort of outside support for. But in general, we want to focus on like, okay, if there's part of my life that is a challenge right now, how do I focus on all the other pieces while still holding space for the challenges that might be going on? We're not ignoring them. We can process them in whatever ways make sense to us, whether that's artistically, therapeutically, through writing, through meditation, through talking to friends, through therapy, whatever makes sense, and still move forward with these other things, right? And sometimes it is adjusting our expectations of ourselves. So if we normally could study for a 2-hour period, we might need to study for a 30-minute period and take more breaks. So again, approaching everything with grace and compassion and trying to figure out what we have control over and seeking support over the things that we might need some some help with.
That segues me nicely into what was going to be my final question, which was, we get to the end of the process, which, you know, in many schooling contexts is sort of the big stressful final set of exams, and it can be a stressful time for everyone in the household. And potentially some of the thoughts you just shared on episodes of kind of more intense kind of trauma and other stuff going on in your life, and some of your thoughts on dealing with that could sort of also be relevant to this question possibly. But if your child is going through stressful exam times, any thoughts for the parents in that home supporting your child through that experience?
Yes. So hopefully, as parents, you've supported your child all along the way with other smaller tests and exams so that they develop some of these habits. But one of the things that we can do as parents is remind students that our memories are consolidated when we sleep. So sleep is so critical, helping them understand that cramming isn't nearly as effective as learning over time. And one day I will actually put that into practice myself. But it's something I still struggle with. But just helping them understand, again, how their brain works, and asking questions like, you know, what's a good breakfast to have the morning of the exam? Like, what do we know? How can we give yourself some protein in the morning? You know, what's going to help kind of feed your brain? We want them to think about overall brain health as much as they are their academic success. So focusing on sleep, focusing on moving their bodies a bit before, taking those study breaks, and really kind of trying to help them get out of that mindset of like, I can't take a break. I can't take a 15-minute break. This is so important. But recognizing that those breaks are actually fueling the process. They're not really breaks, especially if you're not just mindlessly scrolling Instagram or something. But if you're actually taking a break, like a walk or a good meal or a snack or drinking water, meditating, whatever that might be, even taking some deep breaths, all of those things will actually help the process of studying. So again, as parents, it's really just helping to keep in mind all of the parameters that help them do better, and also letting them know that whatever happens, it'll be okay. They'll get through it, and you'll help them through it, and it'll be okay, right? That their entire lives sometimes feel like it rests on one exam, but ultimately, you know, that's not how life works, thankfully. But as I said, hopefully we spent sort of their academic lifetime instilling those skills and habits beforehand. But also just trying to remember as parents that it's not our academic exams. And so sometimes we get so caught up in the outcome for ourselves that we feel the stress and pressure, and then they're feeding off of us, right? Like, why aren't you studying right now? What did you do today? And just asking them a barrage of questions that's just going to increase their stress. So being able to do whatever we can to calm ourselves too, because it is a stressful time. We might need to back off a little bit in some of our expectations of them at home during that period. So if they have some chores or responsibilities, we might need to back off a little bit to give them a bit more grace and room in that respect too.
Smart. I think that's great advice. Yeah, so many useful thoughts on what to do and perhaps what not to do, and some of the things to, you know, ease off on a little bit when academic pressures get their most intense towards exam season.
Yes. Well, one other thing just came to me. One of my actually favorite pieces of advice to give families when they're studying for these big tests is to help students understand that active studying is generally better than passive studying, meaning the more that we can either explain it to somebody verbally or write it out, we're going to do better than just reading something over. So if parents really are feeling kind of helpless and they want to get involved, one of the things that they can do is say, like, let's go for a walk and you can teach me about whatever it is, whatever they're studying. So be the recipient of that information, and you don't have to know anything. You don't have to check the answers are right. What will happen is, much like many of us, when we think we understand a concept and then we try to explain it to someone else and we realize, oh, I don't know that as well as I thought I did. Even just going for a walk and having them try to explain the thing to you that they're working on is a great way to assist as a parent and to help highlight areas that they need to focus on a little bit more.
Yes, this is the power of retrieval practice. When we pull knowledge out of our memory, it helps it to, it's the best way, it's the foundation of any effective way to get it to stick. And, you know, there's the explain a topic to me example. You know, at the end of the day, sitting down with students and saying, well, what did you learn today? I mean, yeah. You know, I often find that's a question that's quite hard for teens to answer because it's quite big and unstructured. So maybe thinking about breaking it down, you know, what lessons did you have today? What lessons did you have last thing in the afternoon? You know, make it a much more baby steps, break down that question into
exactly
sort of little segments. And okay, you had history last thing. Okay, what topic are you doing in history? Oh, it's World War II. Okay, great. What are you talking about today? And then so you sort of lead them by the hand a little bit more. And
exactly,
I think that's a nice way to get a bit more engagement in that question. I mean, certainly I remember when I was a teen, you know, yep. what did you do at school today? I'd be like, ooh.
Nothing.
And parents wouldn't get anything from me. And I was a reasonably bright kid. Like, I'd have been able to articulate it, yep. But it's just such a weighty
exactly
question. Yeah.
Yes.
But there's definitely ways to work a bit better, I think.
Yes.
So, yeah, great. Well, look, I mean, such great advice. And just to pick up on something you mentioned earlier, the bit about time we spend away from the work, the going on the walk, the doing the self-care stuff, like the sleep. Sometimes, well, quite often, I think, by taking a bit less time to study and then, you know, making sure we've got all the other stuff, self-care stuff, looking after ourselves right, our overall productivity in terms of useful output,
yes,
in a day, in a week, actually goes up.
Yes.
Not down, because we've taken better care of ourselves.
Absolutely.
We often sum it up as the power of studying smarter, not necessarily harder.
Exactly.
It's not just about more efficient study leads to that you can study less time. When you study less, that gives you the space to take better care of yourself, and that allows you to study with more intensity and more efficient study time. So
that's right. It's not an either or. We're not sacrificing academics for mental health or vice versa. They support each other.
And it's a more enjoyable time as well as a result. Tamara, I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for being so generous with your wisdom and the various things you've shared today. It's been huge fun chatting. I just wondered if you had a sort of a closing thought for listeners, anything you'd to highlight or share beyond what you've mentioned already. Anything by way of a sort of closing little nugget to leave listeners with.
Well, I just want to thank you for having me. This was a very fun conversation. And I think, you know, you said it really well, that everything we do has to think about our whole selves. And so I just want to come back to that part and remind students that they are more than just students. They are whole people, and that they will be better students when we take care of all of their emotional, social well-being, physical well-being. So just a reminder to take care of our whole selves, both as parents and as students.
This has been a great conversation. If people want to find out more about you and your work and the things you do, where would you point them to?
They can visit my website, which is drtamarasouls.com. And I have some free resources on there for parents navigating anxiety or stress with their child and various other elements. And I have an online course for parents as well there. So they can go to my website and check out the resources there.
Wonderful. Well, I'll be sure to link that up in the show notes. And my little girl herself is currently 2 years old, so the world of sort of academic pressure is hopefully a little way off for us, but I'll be sure to bear that in mind and heed all your very sensible advice in the years to come, Tamara. So thank you so much once again, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
Well, that was good, wasn't it? I found myself taking notes. If you need a reminder of anything from today, head to the website for a write-up of this episode, as well as lots more top-notch advice and resources. That's examstudyexpert.com. See you next time.